7654321.
Hi there and welcome to The Headline. I'm Simon Head and I've got an interview double header to bring you on this week's show. Scotland's Joanne Calderwood has been handed the opportunity of a lifetime, with a strawweight contender set to face Paige VanZant in the main event of UFC Fight Night Las Vegas, on the biggest week of fights in UFC history. I spoke on the phone with Joanne, who chatted to me from a training camp in Thailand as she starts to make her preparations for the bout at the Cosmopolitan on December the 10th. But first up, I caught up with Dan the Outlaw Hardy, who spoke to me from Rio de Janeiro after sailing from London to Rio as part of the Great Britain team in the Clipper Round the World Yacht Race. As if being a professional fighter in the UFC wasn't hardcore enough for him, Dan decided to take on this challenge despite having no sailing experience whatsoever. By the time he actually set sail around a month ago, he'd had just 4 weeks of training, but helped Team Great Britain to a third place finish on the London to Rio leg of the race. Hardy and his team completed the 5,500-mile first leg of the race, sailing through all conditions and dealing with bad weather, injury and the worst possible news, with the loss of a fellow crewmate from a rival vessel. Now he's back on terra firma once again. He's now preparing to call UFC Fight Night Dublin on October 24th, where he'll take his seat at Octagon side alongside John Gooden to commentate on what promises to be one of the most raucous nights of fights in the UFC calendar. Despite his non-stop schedule, I was able to grab a few minutes on the phone with Dan in Rio. Here's what he had to say. All right, how's it going, Dan?
Oh, it's Simon. You all right, mate? Yeah, good, mate. You?
First thing, I just want to say massive congratulations. It's an incredible achievement that you've just done. What's next? You climbing Kilimanjaro or exploring the North Pole next?
Yeah, not sure next. Not sure. See what presents itself to me.
Brilliant. And now, are you in Rio right now? I saw an Instagram post. I didn't know how old it was of you and Jose Aldo.
Yeah, I'm actually at his gym right now.
All right.
Jose's just left.
Okay. How was all that?
Awesome. Yeah, I joined on the wrestling practice this morning and grappled with Aldo a little bit and with Johnny Eduardo, who's also on the upcoming card in Vegas. So it's great. Just a fantastic gym. You know, they've got a real depth of experience. There's a jiu-jitsu class going on one side now. They've got a boxing class on the other. So, yeah, it's a really good gym, really good place to be preparing.
Just to get back to your trip that you've just been on, was it 5,000 miles? Is it something like that, isn't it? 5,000 miles?
Yeah, about 5,500, yeah.
And you did that, was it 1 or 2 months training you were given before you did this?
I did 1 month. I did 4 weeks, and then the race was 4 weeks.
So how does an experience like this sort of change you as a person? Because I can imagine you've experienced things in the last few weeks that you would never have experienced before, right?
Yeah, most definitely. I mean, there are so many different phases you go through, so many different emotions. I mean, you know, the first one is you get on the boat, that race start, and we sailed down the Thames, and there were people all the way along the Thames waving us off and cheering, and we had spectator boats, and so we knew that it was something quite special that we were doing. But then as soon as race started the next morning, we left Southend. I think it was noon we started. I mean, very dramatic. You know, we've got 12 boats and we're all trying to edge ahead of each other. Sail changes going on, big waves, people getting drenched. But then as soon as we got into the channel, we started to lose sight of the boats. And then that was quite a difficult thing for me, because I'm used to competing with someone that's standing right in front of me. So to be competing against a fleet of boats that I can't see, and to know that I'm effectively locked in for 4 weeks, because no matter what emotions you go through, no matter how desperately you want to get off the boat, there's no way off. I mean, we had a guy that 10 days before the end of the race broke both bones in his forearm, and was on the boat for 10 days with a makeshift splint, basically.
Wow.
So it's, you know, there's not the option to get off, and you kind of, you have to face that, and you have to kind of keep giving yourself a bit of a pep talk and convincing yourself that, you know, you just got to focus on being in the moment, being present, and focus on saving the boat more than anything. It's for the destination.
Presumably on a crew like that, everyone has got preset roles. There are certain people who have designated certain roles on the boat. What was your specific role on the boat?
Well, we started off without any roles. I mean, there are you know, we had the skipper, and then we had two watch leaders for each of the shifts. So they had their set roles. But to be honest, you kind of fall into the roles that you're most suited to. I'm effectively the hired muscle on the boat, so it was all, you know, working the grinder, sweating up the sails, and then because I like the adrenaline rush, I'm the guy that's out on the bowsprit doing sail changes and up the mast doing rig checks. So I'm doing kind of the extremities of the boat. I did do a lot of helming. I'm not very good at staying focused on steering and constantly oversteering the boat. So I stuck with my strengths, which was basically the more physical stuff on the boat, and I enjoyed that far more. And then other people fall into different roles, you know, maintenance roles. We had a guy that was an engineer that was fantastic at repairing the water maker and the generator and anything that was not going very well. So, you know, you just kind of naturally fall into the roles that you're strongest at. And because, you know, during the training levels, it was about learning every role on the boat. But when it comes to race, you need to be doing the things that you're most proficient at to get the boat moving as quickly as possible. So we all kind of accepted what roles we fell into and did our best at what we could.
You talk about the sort of physical side of it, and that's obviously where your experience lies, if you like. You know, you're used to that side of things. And you've touched on part of the mental aspect of being on a trip like this. Now, I know from reading your blog, you obviously mentioned about the tragic loss of a crew member of one of the other boats. How did that get communicated to you guys on the boat, and what was the reaction on the boat to that news?
Well, the first thing that happened is I was actually on the 6 a.m. shift. So when we woke up, we found out that there was that the media was locked down. There was no communications back and forth to race office other than the skipper. And we assumed that something had happened on one of the boats. We didn't understand the severity of it at the time. But when more information came through a couple of hours later, it hit the crew hard. I'll be honest. I mean, even the people on the boat that didn't know Andrew were feeling it, because you kind of forget that you're competing against each other for a minute. You know, although we're 12 boats and we're 12 crews, we're effectively a fleet of boats of one big crew. I mean, there are 690 people that crew the boats throughout the race, and we're all a part of the same thing. So he effectively was one of my crew members as well. And I remember speaking to him during the training levels. He was such a friendly guy, full of energy, big MMA fan as well. He talked to me about my GSP fight. You know, and it just kind of puts things into perspective how treacherous the environment is that we're in, how unpredictable the weather is that we're in, and how that can affect the environment around us. And also, you know, how close you become to people within a few days of their company. I thought I was going to struggle with being around people for a month, for, you know, 24 hours a day and being in close quarters and stuff. But you become more of a family than anything else. You know, you're looking out for each other and you want to keep each other safe. And when you hear a boat lost a crew member, immediately you think about the people on your boat and how you would feel if you were in the same situation. And it's a terrible situation. But also, you know, we're getting on the boat knowing the risk. You know, we know how dangerous it is out there, and we're doing it because of the challenge. So, you know, with the challenge comes the risk, and it's unfortunate that Andrew didn't make it to his destination, but he certainly will be remembered.
Yeah, I mean, I can't even begin to fathom what it must have felt like on the boat when that news came through. That bad news aside, what was the hardest part of that trip for you? Was there a specific point during the journey where you know you were at your lowest point and you found it particularly tough?
Yeah, I would say it was probably just over a week in. And it would have been around the same time as we got that news. But more than anything, it was when sleep started to catch up with me, because I'm used to having complete control of my training camps. You know, I get a good 9-10 hours sleep a night and do two training sessions. And in between, I'm making my own food, so I know I'm eating the things that I want to eat and that refuel me. Whereas when you're on the boat, you hand all that control over. You know, I was being woken up three times a day to start a shift, and the food was a struggle for me to get used to, because, you know, I only eat generally when I'm feeling like I'm hungry, and when you're on the boat, you're handed food at the right times for your shift. So that was a struggle. But when fatigue starts to set in, and you know, I was going on about 2 hours sleep a day, you start to kind of, you know, you start to think about the destination more than anything, and focus on getting to Rio. When you're constantly looking at the tracker, and you're knowing that you've still got another 2 weeks, another 3 weeks to go, it can really start to get to you. You can start, you know, feeling kind of short-tempered with people and impatient. And it's just not helpful for the environment on the boat. So, that, you know, there were a couple of times I had to give myself a good talking to and remind myself, you know, what I've put myself through previously in my life and that I can do this. You know, I will get to my destination and I can't forget every day in between. And that was the lesson I got from training camps. You know, I'd go into a training camp starting 10 weeks out from a fight, and every day I would wake up thinking about the fight day and not thinking about that particular day of training and not staying present. And I got into that habit on the boat, and then, you know, after a bit of talking to myself, I realised that if I just get up every day and focus on saving the boat, the destination will arrive when it arrives, and I'll be in a much stronger state of mind every day to just get up and give it my best. And certainly what with, you know, and with losing Andrew, that was a reinforcement of, you know, make sure you're enjoying the day that you're in, not thinking too far ahead and losing time as it passes you by, thinking about a distant goal.
Was there any opportunity for you guys, I mean, this almost sounds like a stupid question, but was there any opportunity to relax on the boat when you weren't on shift? What were you doing when you weren't actually on duty and not sleeping? What were you actually doing on the boat to fill the time? Or was there any downtime?
It's kind of difficult. Yeah, although there is downtime, you know, I mean, we do get a few hours here and there to sleep and stuff. The boat's always moving, and the environment's always uncomfortable. And after the first few days, the heat was you know, pretty insufferable. So there's nowhere you can go on the boat where you're not sweaty and uncomfortable, or wearing a life jacket and clipped onto the boat. And dehydration was a big issue as well. We're always constantly trying to stay hydrated. But, you know, downtime, there really wasn't a great deal. You know, I spent a bit of time laying in my bunk doing a bit of writing, and I spent some time in the sail locker meditating because that was one of the quietest places on the boat. But then as soon as we got into bigger seas, there's not a single place on the boat that's comfortable. You just kind of have to brace yourself in a particular position or, you know, just kind of accept the environment that you're in and try and ride it best you can. But you never relax. There's never a moment, even when you're asleep, you're not fully asleep. It's not a deep sleep, because you're probably only going to get 2 or 3 hours, and then, you know, you've always got one eye open. You've always kind of listening out for that man overboard cry, or, you know, there's a sail change that's gone wrong that needs extra hands. So, you know, always ready to throw a life jacket on and get up on deck and start sailing the boat again.
Yeah.
The first day I actually got to rest was when I got to the hotel and closed the door and just kind of crashed. It's like, yeah, absolutely exhaustive. And you just, you know, you run on adrenaline for most of the time. And conversation as well, that was one major factor for motivation for me. You know, we had good conversation on the boat. We all kept each other motivated.
Explain to us, if you can, the emotion when you first saw land, when you first saw Brazil.
It was a little bit surreal. And strangely, I mean, I've been waiting for, you know, to see land since we left the UK. But when we actually saw Rio, it was a bit surreal, and there was a hesitation to get off the boat, even when we got into the marina. Even when the boat was moored up, there was a bit of a hesitation to step off. I don't know, it was weird. I'd become, I don't know, almost institutionalised, I guess. You know, you kind of get used to your environment and used to the dynamics around you with the relationships. And the idea of stepping off the boat into a city like Rio as well, where it's, you know, it's such a vibrant place and there's so much going on. It was a little overwhelming, to be honest. It was nice to see Rio in the distance and to know that we were getting close. But when the time came to actually sail into Rio and get off, it was weird. There was definitely a hesitation there, and I definitely felt like I wanted to stay on the boat for a bit longer.
Now you're back on terra firma, the thoughts, I guess, turn back to the day job, and you've got a live event to call in 2 weeks in Dublin. How do you even begin to sort of switch your mindset back to being sort of the UFC's analyst for this sort of event?
Well, it was on my mind quite a lot during the race, and you know, obviously I was missing all the live fights and stuff that were going on, but I had a good look at the card before I left, and I knew, you know, the kind of fighters that I'd be looking at, and I'm familiar with a lot of them already anyway. So I just, you know, I spent a lot of time while I was on the boat thinking about the fight, thinking about my job and about my role with the UFC and you know, where I can improve. So I'm very eager for fight night in Dublin. I've been doing a lot of research this weekend, and I feel like I've got a good idea of the main and co-main event. So I'm excited to get back to London and start recording some shows for the event, and then get out to Dublin. It's going to be an amazing event, and I'm eager to get back into it. I like to be in amongst the MMA fans and fighters. I feel very much at home there, and I'm ready to really kind of give it my all when we get to Dublin. I'm expecting a fantastic night.
It should be a cracker. Well, look, I've taken up probably far too much of your time already. So thanks so much for your time, Dan. And I'll be over there in Dublin, so hopefully I'll grab a word with you over a coffee or something while we're there.
Yeah, mate, that sounds good. It'd be good to see you.
Great stuff. Thanks a lot, Dan, and congratulations again, man. That's pretty awesome stuff.
Cheers, mate. Thank you, mate. I'll speak to you soon.
And there you have it, a remarkable story from a truly remarkable man, Dan the Outlaw Hardy. I don't know about you, but I can't begin to fathom what he's just achieved, and I can only doff my cap to the man. Incredible stuff. As well as that, I'm also really looking forward to hearing him and John Gooden back on commentary for the Dublin event at the end of this month. Now, I know a lot of people prefer to have the American commentary team. It's what they're used to. It's what they sort of grew up with when they were learning the sport, if you like. But with this sport growing worldwide, I think it's absolutely vital to the development of MMA on this side of the pond that the sport is able to have knowledgeable British voices calling the action when the fights are held over here. And with the experience of the pair of them, with John's smooth delivery on the microphone and experience of calling MMA fights, and with Dan's world championship level experience inside the Octagon, they pretty much make for the perfect team for EMEA over here on this side of the pond. It'll be great to have them back behind the mic later this month for UFC Fight Night Dublin. Right, on to the second part of the headline, and I was able to speak to Joanne Calderwood, who joined me on the phone from her training camp in Thailand as she prepares to face rising star Paige VanZant at UFC Fight Night in Las Vegas on December 10th. JoJo's had a roller coaster of a year, but she's ending it on a real high with her first ever UFC main event and the chance to kick off the UFC's triple header of events in spectacular fashion and push her claims for a title shot in a women's strawweight division. The line isn't the very best on this call, it's a little bit crackly at points, so apologies for that, but it's great to hear from Jo as she gets ready for the biggest night of her career. Here's what she had to say. Hi Jo, how are you?
Hi Simon, how are you? I'm good.
You've got yourself probably the biggest fight of your career. You're in a main event in Las Vegas. Tell us how the fight came about and the reaction that you had when you found out that you were going to be main eventing in Las Vegas in what's probably the biggest week of UFC fights in UFC history.
Yeah, so basically Sean Shelby asked me if I wanted to fight in December, and I was like, yeah, definitely. And then a couple of days later, he said, okay, it's going to be against Paige, and it's going to be December time. So I was like, okay. And then I looked up the events in December, and I was like, wow, imagine it's under McGregor's the fight, McGregor's headline. And then a couple of days later, Sean said, I phoned Sean, and then he says, right, that's it, confirmed, you're going to be fighting Paige, and you're going to be headlining on the 10th. So I was like, wow, that's amazing. It's kind of like McGregor's undercard, but I'm headlining it. So it's going to be an awesome week, and I'm really grateful to be part of it.
You've had a bit of a roller coaster ride of a year, but in Glasgow, you really seem to get your mojo back. It was an incredible atmosphere in the Hydro that night, and watching you fight from Octagon side, it almost seemed as if you sort of flipped a switch mid fight and went into sort of beast mode and just really went for it in that fight with Courtney Casey. Tell us about that fight and just how important it was for you. That, you know, the fact it was in your hometown, and it started out as a really, really tough encounter for you, but you really powered through and got that win.
Yeah, it was like the first, like when I went into the Octagon, I was trying to stay focused and kind of not take the whole atmosphere in, but once I got into the Octagon, it was really hard not to, and like I was just like amazed at how much support and the feeling of being standing there and ready to fight in front of all these fans, friends and family. It was a really, really special moment, and as well, like, my whole fight camp for that fight was, like, up and down, and I didn't really have, I would say I had a good 1 week of good training, so I knew I was just, like, so mentally wanting a good fight to kind of just a fight with myself. So, yeah, it ended up being a good fight, and I enjoyed every second of it. And I just felt like I had overcame something getting through the fight. And I probably wouldn't have been able to do it without the amount of support I got, and especially on the night.
The actual event itself was fantastic, and there seemed to be a real buzz around the media for that event as well. Both the MMA media, who cover the sport regularly, but also there seemed to be a load of national press and sort of local press coverage in Glasgow that week. Have you noticed your profile increase in Scotland since that fight?
Yeah, and I kind of noticed that when I fought for the UFC and went on the Ultimate Fighter. But yeah, of course, that event, because a lot of people didn't even know the UFC existed and stuff, and I don't think local people do know until, like, events such as the UFC come to Glasgow and put on the events that they do, you know. Then it kind of educates a lot of people that might not even follow the sport, but it just interested them because it's in the hometown. So I think it was a very big success.
You're known as a fighter who doesn't deal in any sort of trash talk or make load of noise about other fighters in your division. But it's quite interesting that yesterday's media day over in Houston, Texas for UFC 192, Angela Hill had a little bit of a pop at you and Paige. She basically said that you've both been sort of groomed for success and hadn't been given the hardest fights in the division. And she even went as far as to say that your fight in Vegas would be sort of a lackluster fight. What's your take on that? What's your opinion on Angela as a fighter?
This isn't the first time she's talked shit and made up stuff and said this, that and the next thing. But, I mean, you have to understand, she's only, like, had two or three fights. And she obviously feels she needs to put herself out there and bad talk everyone and that kind of stuff to get fights. Whereas, I think, personally for myself, my personality isn't to talk shit about people. I just get my head down and train hard, and that's when I want to get the success from working hard and not having to open my mouth. It's just other people are different, and that's Angela Hull's way of doing it, but I just ignore it. And I mean, I think the UFC is as well, because she isn't getting these opportunities and stuff. So I mean, my advice to her would be just to train, and just fingers crossed that she gets a fight. But there's no point in adding drama or putting all that stress and pressure on yourself and just calling out girls and because it's obviously not working.
Yeah, back to your fight in Vegas. Give me your assessment of Paige as a fighter. She's obviously very young, and she wasn't able to be a part of the Ultimate Fighter. I think she was too young to be in the house. So she ended up in the UFC by other means. She sort of went in directly. How do you see her strengths and weaknesses, and what are your thoughts on her as a fighter?
I really like her, and I think she's a very exciting fighter. I like her personality, and she's got a lot of hype. She's young, and all round I like her, and I think she's going to make a real exciting fight. So obviously you need two to tango, so it's going to be a good night for the both of us. So I was going to say, as for her not being in the Ultimate Fighter house, I think that was good for her. Not yeah. Being part of that.
Yeah, I remember talking to you after the show, and you said it was a bit stressful at times, lots of all those different personalities in the house. Looking forward to 2016, the sport in Europe really seems to be kicking off. You know, European MMA seems to be on a real high right now. You know, we had that really successful event in Scotland, we've had a big successful event in Sweden, we've got London coming up, obviously we've got Dublin coming up in a couple of weeks. What are your plans for 2016? Do you sit down with your manager and say, right, this is how we want to try and get through the next year, how many fights you want to have, the sort of fighters you're looking to sort of target and things like that. What are your plans for the next 12 months?
My plan for is to win with Paige, and then maybe another couple of fights, and then obviously my dream would be to eventually fight for the title, and the cherry on the top would be if the UFC came back to Scotland. But obviously I don't make the decisions and have to wait and see what their plans are, because my plans might be completely different to theirs. But yeah, that would be a pretty cool dream if that happened, if I could get another 2 or 3 wins and then fight for the title.
Best of luck with all the training over there in Thailand. Thanks so much for your time, I really appreciate it, and look forward to talking to you a little bit nearer the fight. I'm going to be over there in Vegas for the fight, so I'll definitely see you over there, if not before.
Awesome, Simon, have a good day.
Great stuff there from Joanne Calderwood. She doesn't do trash talk, does she? But she certainly has some helpful advice for her strawweight colleague Angela Hill there. Angela unfortunately went on and lost to Rose Namajunas by first round submission at UFC 192 after she made her comments in the media day. So that search for a big win continues for Angie Overkill. Who knows, maybe a Calderwood v Hill fight could happen further down the line. That would certainly be an interesting one if that were to happen. But for now, JoJo has her focus firmly on Paige VanZant, with a good win likely to push her right up into title contention. Whether you call her Bad Mofo JoJo, her original nickname, or the more politically correct Dr. Nevil, you can bet she'll have plenty of support in Las Vegas on fight night on December the 10th. And that brings us to the end of the headline this week. I hope you enjoyed the interviews. Hopefully I'll have a few more to bring you in the weeks to come. Coming up in the next couple of weeks, we'll have interviews with Stipe Miocic and Ben Rothwell ahead of their pivotal co-main event battle at UFC Fight Night Dublin. Plus, I'm hoping to get one or two more interviews in the can as well, including one with Britain's main man in The Ultimate Fighter, the Hangman himself, Saul Rogers. If you've got any questions, feedback, suggestions, etc., please feel free to hit me up on Twitter. I'm at Simon Head. You can also read my stuff on The Sun's website at www.thesun.co.uk/UFC, as well as in my weekly UFC column in The Sun newspaper here in the UK every Monday. Until next time, enjoy the fights, and I'll speak to you soon.